I like it when songs slip from declaration to petition so seamlessly. Did you know that in the song we just sang, there was a prayer? Every time you sing, O Canada, there's a prayer. God keep our land. And all the pagans at Commonwealth Stadium who were loaded just before the big game, they are saying a prayer. And I have to believe that God hears prayers from some of the most unlikely of candidates. So, not you, but kind of neat that we can build prayer into our different forms of worship. So I was out for my Saturday night walk, and I noticed that down one of the side streets, there was like this oversized candy cane. And so I swung down there. I couldn't believe the various themes on this gentleman's front yard. Some might even think there were some conflicting themes, but there's Jesus, Mary, Joseph. And then over here, there's Mr. and Mrs. Santa Claus. And then I think Rudolph was there, along with Frosty. So I thought, wow, this is one busy lawn. Just lots going on here. So maybe I'll get a chance to meet them sometime. Today, of course, is Advent, and many of you know that the word Advent, I mean, that just has so slipped into Canadiana that we use it maybe without even thinking about it. It derives from a word that means arrival, coming, and has been used by the Church Universal to describe usually a period leading up to December 25th when we call ourselves to remember that 2,000 years ago, God arrived in a pretty amazing way. And so Advent is just the little code word that we use. And as we think about Advent, of course, not very far away, there is something that we all have. Let's go to the next slide. We all have one of these. Matthew is pretty aware of trees, sometimes called family trees. And he begins his telling of the Advent story by taking us right to Jesus' genealogy. And I want to prepare you now. I'm going to read it. Okay, so you do whatever you need to do to get ready for 17 verses of genealogy. It's there. It's inspired. It teaches us. So I'm just assuming that it's meant not only to be studied, but also to be read. But everybody's got one of these. I mean, everybody. Even this family has one of them. And it's a pretty colorful cast of characters. I used to not ever watch this show. I had seen part of an episode, and I just didn't think it was very, you know, edifying. And my kids said to me, "No, Dad, you got to sit down and watch The Simpsons." So I did sit down with them a number of times. I don't know if it was, you know, the high point of our quality family time together, but I did learn a few things about this interesting family. And, of course, they have a family tree. They have a bit of ancestry as well, and you get to know them. So what I want to do today is to, actually, I want to tell you a little bit about my family tree, because I have one, too. The Simpsons have one. I have one, too. A couple of years ago, I wanted to do some genealogical research, and I didn't know exactly how to do that, so I got a book, and they sent me to some websites. And so we dug around a little bit to see what we could find out about the Weebs. My parents had some information already, and I was actually pretty disappointed. There wasn't a lot of information, and the little bit that I did get was pretty sketchy. I mean, I know about my grandpa, my dad's dad, Peter Weeb is his name, was a what I would call a subsistence farmer in southern Manitoba, by today's standards, very poor, mainly farmed for themselves, you know, just enough meat for themselves, vegetables for themselves, a little bit of extra milk so they could sell it to the local dairy in Grunthal, Manitoba. A pretty understated man. My grandpa didn't speak English. Either he didn't speak it well, or because he knew German, and I think he thought Low German, Plotdeutsch, was God's language, he didn't use English very often, and so the downside was we never built a relationship with my grandpa. And I grieve that, because I think he probably could have added a lot to our lives as children. But a pretty ordinary guy who, you know, went to work every day, did the things that he needed to do to provide for the family. One of my uncles was, I guess we'd call him an alcoholic. He had some addictions in his life, and their family life was not a very happy life. One child, my cousin, and my uncle did not treat my aunt well. I can remember as a child going with my parents. My parents took us everywhere. They didn't shield us from anything. And we had to go to my uncle's place to do an intervention. So a couple of our uncles were there, and they brought their kids, and we kind of all witnessed this thing happening. So that was a bit of a dark side to my family history. And then I had another uncle who was like a super devout Baptist. We went to the same church that they went to for a number of years. And like this guy, like in their way of structuring church, almost at the top of the pile, just under God, is the pastor. And we don't have that problem here at Balmoral. And then below that, there are, you know, the various people who attend the congregants. And of all the people in the congregants, my uncle was like almost at the top of the pile. He was a Bible answer man. This guy seemed to know everything there was to know about all things Christian. And if you had a question, you took it to my uncle, he had an answer, and if he didn't have an answer, he'd go find the answer, and he would get back to you. Well, sadly, my uncle was diagnosed with leukemia in his middle years, and he did eventually die because of that. And it was a real crisis in his life. It was a crisis of faith. And I'm just a teenage boy, and I don't understand all these things. But as his personal drama played out, he had these very dark times where God seemed absent. And it just so frustrated him, and he became angry. He became angry with the church, and he felt that the reason why God wasn't healing him was because the church people didn't have enough faith. And he was angry at God because God wasn't coming through. And so this is not an uncommon experience for people to go through. And we, in our own way, we witnessed this as children. I think before he passed on, he kind of came to terms. Him and God somehow made peace. So that was kind of neat. So those are just a few stories from my family tree. There are many more. I think in many ways we were a pretty ordinary bunch. I don't think there's anybody that's famous. I don't think there's anybody that's particularly wealthy. I don't know that anybody got the Order of Canada in my family, but that's the weeds in all their living color. Well, I find it interesting that when Matthew wants to tell his version of the Christmas story, where he takes us is the genealogy of Jesus. And so we want to go there today, and we want to consider God's work in times past. So let's read through this, okay? Have you got your boots on? Are you braced for this? We're going to read through the genealogy from the NIV, starting in Matthew 1:1. Here we go. And as we're doing this, by the way, I want you to see if you can connect with some of the names that are mentioned. I want you to just quickly think about some of the stories that might be associated with them. Here we go. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abram. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, Judah the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. We just studied about Tamar, so we should remember her. Perez the father of Hezron, Hezron the father of Ram, Ram the father of Amminadab, Amminadab the father of Nashon, Nashon the father of Salmon, Solomon, the father of Boaz. So now we're back into familiar territory. Whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed. Whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of King David. So that's the first sort of stanza. There's two more. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. There's some drama right there. Just hidden in that one little line. Solomon, the father of Rehoboam. Rehoboam, the father of Abijah. Abijah, the father of Asa. Asa, the father of Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat, the father of Jehoram. Jehoram, the father of Uzziah. You heard the name Uzziah? Where does Uzziah's name appear in the Old Testament? That's right, Isaiah. For some of us, that's where we maybe first heard it, was in Isaiah. Uzziah, the father of Jotham. Jotham, the father of Ahaz. Ahaz, the father of Hezekiah. Hezekiah, the father of Manasseh. Manasseh, the father of Ammon. Ammon, the father of Josiah. and Josiah, the father of Jeconiah, and his brothers at the time of the exile to Babylon. Now, in Jewish thinking, that was huge. The exile to Babylon. That was the great crisis of faith that took place in the story of Israel. And then finally, after the exile to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel. Shealtiel, the father of Zerubbabel. Just kind of bang your lips together. Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel, the father of Abihud. Abihud, the father of Eliakim. Eliakim, the father of Azor. Azor, the father of Zadok. Zadok, the father of Achim. Achim, the father of Elihud. Elihud, the father of Eleazar. Eleazar, the father of Mathan. Mathan, the father of Jacob. And Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary. And Mary was the mother of Jesus, who is called the Messiah. Thus, there were 14 generations in all, from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile to Babylon, and 14 from the exile to the Messiah. We should wonder, what's up with this genealogy? The genealogy, by the way, is not complete. It is selective. If you go to the Old Testament, you will find that there are names that have been skipped. And so Matthew, by focusing on these characters, this cast of characters, I think is trying to make some points. The very first point that he would have us to understand from verse 1, this is the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham, is that God was faithful. In verse 1, he draws attention to the promise-making, promise-keeping character of God. God had made promises to David. He had made promises to Abraham. And Matthew seems to be reminding his readers that God has kept these promises. And his way of keeping these promises is a person. And that person is Jesus. Well, what kind of promises did he make to David? Several. But one of the more notable promises was that David would one day have a descendant whose dynasty and rule would last forever. Now, they didn't know when this descendant would appear. But 2 Samuel talks about this. Isaiah talks somewhat extensively about this amazing ruler. He would be a world ruler. He wouldn't simply rule Palestine. He would rule the world, and non-Jewish people would come and acknowledge his kingship. And he would inaugurate a time of unparalleled peace, something that no ruler had ever been able to do. And he would be wise, way wiser than Solomon was ever wise. That promise of a coming ruler, Matthew says, has been fulfilled in a person, and that person is Jesus. The other person that promises were made to, of course, was Abraham. Genesis 12, where the story of Abraham begins. When the world was going to hell in a handbasket, and that's what's happening, right at the end of chapters 10 and 11, the Tower of Babel, the whole creation project is going sideways again, God raises up a man, Abraham, and he says, Abraham, I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you, and I will bless your descendants, and you will be agents of universal blessing. All peoples of earth will be blessed. And Matthew says, God has kept that promise too, and his fulfillment of that promise is a person, and that person is Jesus. So God's way of keeping his promises was very personal. Kind of reminds me of one of the stories in the opening chapters of Genesis. I know the chapel did a study on Genesis just before I came, or as I was coming. There's that great moment in Genesis chapter 2 where Adam realizes that he is all by himself. He discovers that one really is the loneliest number. And you remember that before God provided him with Eve, what he did? He gave him a job. He gave him a task. He said, Adam, I want you to name all the animals. And so he began to do that. And one of the things that he would have observed is that for each of the animals, there was a Mr. Giraffe and there was a Mrs. Giraffe. And for the zebra and for the monkey, there was a he and there was a she. And as Adam was naming these animals, there arose within him this profound sense of aloneness. And God's way of answering that problem was a person. And she had a name. It was Eve. And God's way of answering his promise of blessing and rule is also a person, and that person is Jesus. So that's the very first point that Matthew makes here in his genealogy. So he reveals himself in the genealogy as a God who works faithfully, but now it gets a little more dicey and difficult to understand what's going on in the rest of the genealogy. We discover now that God is a person who works oddly. Oddly enough, he works oddly. And by oddly, I mean not what we would have expected. And we see this over and over again. And perhaps as we were reading through the genealogy, you were thinking of, oh yeah, I remember that story, and oh, and then it was that story, and then, oh, that was really weird, and I can't believe this happened over here. There was just a lot of odd stuff that happened in the history of Israel. And Jesus associates Jesus, or Matthew rather, associates Jesus with this odd storyline. God was working mysteriously. We sometimes say, the Lord works in mysterious ways, his wonders to perform. That may be about as theologically direct as Hollywood gets in its movies. I just heard that the other day in a movie. The Lord works in mysterious ways, his wonders to perform. It's so true, isn't it? Over and over again, and maybe you look at your own life, you can say with great conviction that that is true as well. So let's just touch down very quickly on some of the people and events through which God worked oddly in the history of Israel. We meet, of course, Abraham. And we all know about Abraham. He was the founder and the father. He was a man of pretty much great patience. His patience wavered a few times, but for the most part, he was a very, very patient man. God came to Abraham and said, you will be the father of a great nation. And he didn't know as much about biology and science as we did, but he understood that to be the father of a great nation, you'd have to have children, right? And you got to have lots and lots of children. And he and Sarah didn't have any children. And for the longest time, they kept on not having any children. And then age took over. Then there was this issue of infertility that was a problem for them as well. And so no children were coming. And they waited and they waited. And God said, now that you're in your 90s, I think we can work with you, Abraham. And so when Abraham was 99, his dear wife Sarah conceived. And if that doesn't strike you as odd, I don't know what will. We come across the name Jacob as well in the genealogy. Jacob, unlike Abraham, Abraham was patient. Jacob was relatively impatient. He's the sort of guy who, when he saw something that he liked, he saw a kind of living that he would enjoy. He just pushed his way into it. He went out and he took it. He didn't wait for it to be offered to him. He was a grabber. Jacob, he was a smoothie. He was a smooth operator. Everything in life that he got seemed to come through trickery and deception. And yet, God blessed him. I don't like Jacob. God loved Jacob and blessed him in so many ways. One of the reasons maybe I don't like Jacob is because he reminds me of me and other people in the world. Then we meet a guy by the name of Judah. What can we say about Judah? I would say Judah was a negligent man. I imagine he was about 6'5". That he had an imposing presence. He was a negligent man. He didn't honor the social and religious obligations that God had laid out for them. It was his job as the head of the household to ensure that the family was built up. And when the family line wasn't being perpetuated, as we saw a number of months ago when we studied about Judah and Tamar, he neglected to fulfill his duty in the ways that he was supposed to. And so his daughter-in-law, Tamar, had to take matters into her own hands, and Judah, thinking that he was going in to see a prostitute, was actually being deceived into having relations with his own daughter-in-law. And out of this immorality and this mess, God saw to it that the family line of Judah was extended. I mean, where would we be without the line of Judah? There might not have been any lion of Judah. And so this all strikes me as very odd as well. Judah the negligent. And then there are four guys who are notable for being so unnotable. Hezron, Ram, Aminadab, and Nahshon. We don't know anything about these guys. We really don't know what they did. We don't know what they accomplished. They're just there. They're part of the storyline. Maybe pretty average, a little less than average. Maybe good, decent guys for all we know, but not a whole lot. Pretty nondescript. Then we come across Boaz. Boaz's mom. Who was Boaz's mom? She was a Canaanite sex trade worker turned Israelite. Her name was Rahab. Right. That's kind of interesting. And Boaz, when presumably later in life, met a young widow, she wasn't Jewish, she was a Gentile, she was a Moabite, and they married. I imagine that would have been good fodder at the local coffee clutch, and had children. And their first child was a little guy by the name of Obed, who one day had a child by the name of Jesse, who one day had a child by the name of David. So that would make Boaz what? Great-grandpa? Great-great-grandpa? Oh, you figured out. Some relation. So God is working through people in rather odd circumstances, accomplishing his will for his people and getting the job done, getting his plan done to put the world right in due course. But not only did God work through people, he also worked through circumstances and events. And one of them, of course, was the exile. And we just sometimes talk glibly about the exile, and we don't appreciate what a crisis of faith it was. I mean, after 4 centuries of covenantal infidelity, God dispatched the Assyrians to demolish the northern kingdom of Israel, and then a little bit later on, the Babylonians to deport many people from the southern kingdom of Judah, and there they were living in far-off Babylon, wondering and mulling and musing and thinking thoughts like, does God even care about us anymore? Does God love us? Do his promises still hold? Is he still obligated to fulfill these commitments that he has made to us? And it was a great crisis of faith. And many of the prophets try to address that sense of loss of faith and confidence in God and just despairing. Little did they know that besides judging them, God was also protecting the nation, a remnant. He was preserving them so that when the right time came, he could continue to work and eventually send Messiah. And then there was this 400-year period that isn't actually described here, but most of us know about it. There were 400 years before the coming of Christ, sometimes called the 400 years of silence, in which God, quite frankly, stopped talking. The people had stopped listening, and so he stopped speaking. And this would have just heightened their sense of despair and questioning about whether God was still loving and working in and through them. But I think what Matthew would have us to understand is that during the story of Israel, God is keeping his promises. God is working. He is being faithful. Not always the way that was expected. Working, oddly enough, through a richly textured cast of characters and international events. The big thing in flooring these days, especially hardwood flooring, is textured product. Now, I've had different kinds of hardwood flooring. In Edmonton, we had a home that had, it was maple hardwood. It was shiny, and it was smooth, and we really enjoyed it. You could, when you're wearing socks, you could kind of head for the hallway and just run, and then you could slide. See how far you could slide. You could do that on non-textured hardwood flooring. But the textured flooring has got real grit. So if you come to our home, we have textured flooring. If there is grain and you run your hand across it, you will feel the grain. If there is a knot hole, you will run your hand over it and you will feel the knot. It kind of shows you what's really there. And to me, that's a good analogy of the kinds of people that God was working with during the story of Israel and that are reflected in this genealogy. These are real people. They weren't always nice people. They weren't always faithful people. They weren't always well-behaved people. These were real people. These were sinful people. And you might have thought that, you know, God's hands were somehow tied and he wasn't able to accomplish his purposes through people like this. To the contrary, he could and he did. They were textured people. Maybe you know some textured people. Maybe you are one of those textured people. So God worked faithfully. The genealogy shows us that God worked, oddly enough, through people of textured personality. And then in verse 16, we see that God worked. And I don't think this is stretching it. I think he worked rather dangerously. We read about this in verse 16. And Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, and Mary, the mother of Jesus, who is called the Messiah. I'm not going to say much about this today because Fred is preaching on this passage next week, and I'll let him tell you the story. But boy, you talk about a complicated pregnancy. I know enough to know that all pregnancies are complicated. I don't know very much about pregnancy, but I do know enough to know that all pregnancies are complicated. It complicates a person's life, a woman's life, to be carrying a child for 9 months. And believe it or not, it even complicates her husband's life and to some extent the other children's life. So pregnancies are always complicated. But Mary's pregnancy was doubly complicated. There were social issues, there were reputational issues, there were legal issues, there were personal security issues. This was a pretty dangerous thing that God did when he sent his son in the form of a child. So if you thought that the odd behavior of God in the earlier part of the genealogy was over, there are more God behaving oddly episodes in the book of Matthew. We'll look at a few of them in our Advent series. So that's about all I want to say about the genealogy. But now I want to try and bring this home a little bit if we can. We've been looking at the family tree, the idea of family tree. We all have one. And all family trees showcase something. And if you have the courage to dig around in your family roots, maybe some of you are afraid to do that. You're not quite sure what you might find. Might be a little more exciting than you had bargained for. But you know, not a bad thing to do. As we look into Jesus' genealogy, it showcases God's work in the past. How reliable he was and how resourceful he was. Well, all that makes me wonder, what will they discover when they look at our family tree? Suppose in a couple of hundred years, some nosy relative, you know, gets onto one of these genealogical research websites and really goes to town and starts digging into their roots. What will they discover? What will they discover about you, me? What would they discover about our families? What would they discover about our values? What would they discover about some of the choices and the key decisions that we made? I mean, it's easy for me to stand up here today and to talk about, you know, Uncle so-and-so or Aunt such-and-such. Well, do I realize that someday people are going to do that for me? And they'll have all this information in hand. What is it that they will learn about our marital journey? Or for some of us, it's in the plural. There's a lot of drama there. There's a lot of pain. There's a lot of disappointment. What will they learn about the ebb and flow of our lives? Probably discover that our relatives had periods of prosperity and periods of poverty. What was that like? How did they cope with that? How did they handle that? That they had times of wellness and times of illness. How did they deal with that? That some of them were known for their godliness and some of them for their paganness, at least for part of their lives. I was a pagan for at least the first 16, 17 years of my life. Probably a person wouldn't have to dig too far to find some dirt on that. Will there be episodes in our lives of prolonged suffering and hardship in which we were remarkably enabled to endure and to be faithful to God? I expect there will be. What would it be like for someone to do some genealogical research on Balmoral Bible Chapel? What would they discover? I think part of what they would discover is that Balmoral enjoyed this amazing 80-year run, and the church knew the incredible faithfulness of God. And then there was we'll call it a hiccup. There was this hiccup for a couple of years where things started to go sideways. And there were some people who thought, uh-oh, this is bad. We're done. There were some people who thought. There were some prophets of doom who thought, uh-oh, Balmoral's done. And all they could see was dust. But if they continue their genealogical research far enough, they'll discover that in time, people began to rise out of the ashes. And they got up. And the first thing they did was they dusted themselves off. And they got their bearings again. And they began to move in a good direction, in a godly direction, in a God-honoring direction. I suspect that's one of the things that people will find out about the genealogy of Balmoral Bible Chapel. They will discover that this happens because God is faithful. And because, as we recently learned in Ephesians, it happens because God is able to do immeasurably more than anything that we could ask or think. It's all because of God. It's because he's faithful. It's because he's good and he's powerful. That's our salvation. So, in conclusion, it's Advent. Be of good cheer.